The United States has sent its largest warship, the aircraft carrier Gerald R. Ford, is now in the waters close to Venezuela, and the world wonders, is something about to happen? Based on what we're told is happening, what the alleged reason for all of this combat power in there doesn't really pass the sniff test, doesn't seem very logical to me, and I have a lot of worries about this. I don't think I'm the only one, and to try and help us unpack some of this and try to figure out what in the world is going on, we have the amazing Alexander Mercurius, co-host of the Durand YouTube channel, and a great friend of the show. Alexander, always a delight to have you here.
And always a pleasure to be here, Daniel.
Well, listen, let's just jump right into it here. You know, this has been something talking about for a while. The Gerald Ford was announced quite some time ago, and it takes a bit of time to steam across the world and get to the waters here. But now here we are, and this is on top of the military buildup that was already somewhere around 14% of the U.S. military naval fleet already. And we have at least a couple of different amphibious assault groups, some Marines, some destroyers, missile carriers, and now here's the Gerald R. Ford. Just kind of, first of all, I'm just kind of, especially as a Briton, what do you think from looking at this from the other side of the pond?
Well, to me, this looks like a preparation for some kind of military attack on Venezuela. And that isn't just my view. I would say that's pretty much the universal view here in Britain. The president, the US government, is speaking about this being as part of some kind of anti-drug smuggling operation in the Caribbean. And there is a lot of that in the Caribbean. But you do not use a US Navy carrier, the most powerful warship, surface warship in the world. You do not deploy 14% of the world's most powerful navy to start dealing with drug smugglers. I mean, it isn't even efficient. There are far more efficient ways of dealing with that than deploying US naval forces. And it's well known that the United States, or at least this particular president and his members of his administration, don't like the setup in Venezuela. Many people in Europe would agree with that, by the way. Many people in Britain do. But to us in Britain, this looks like preparation for some kind of strike against Venezuela. I think that is the overwhelming consensus here.
And it's, you know, it's tough to find a rational reason why. Because, look, we obviously during Trump's first term, for those who may not know, there was a really ham-fisted attempt to facilitate a coup with, at that time, one of their parliamentary leaders, Juan Guaido, who claimed that he was the legitimate president of Venezuela, despite the fact that Maduro was sitting in the position of the president. Lots of protests inside the country, and we just completely and utterly failed. It was a humiliation about how far we tried to go, but we didn't use military power then. And if one gets a feeling that maybe the current administration and the current batch in the Trump administration is saying, well, that was our fatal mistake last time. We're not going to repeat that again. And we've had people like Lindsey Graham have come out and just emphatically said, yeah, we need a regime change here. That's what we're all about. Senator Scott, another U.S. senator, has said, yeah, he's got to go. So when you hear all these statements by senior administration officials, especially those like Lindsey Graham, who are very close to the president, one has to wonder, is that where we're going now? And what puzzles me, though, and I'd like your observations on this, what is the objective here? What do you want to accomplish? I mean, is it as simple, do you think, as there's a lot of oil in Venezuela?
Well, I think that is partly, that's part of it, and probably a big, big part of it, because Venezuela does indeed have a lot of oil. And Venezuelan oil has been an important part of U.S. economic history. Many people don't know, for example, that Venezuela provided a lot of the oil that was used by the Allies to fight and win the Second World War. So it goes back that far. I don't think it's just oil. I think at one level, I suspect there is a degree of unfinished business, exactly as you said, that the Venezuelan government survived previous attempts at destabilization. There's probably also a degree of personal animus on the part of this president and some of his people towards a person who they see as a Latin American socialist. And I think that probably plays into some of the feelings that some people in the administration have about socialists and, you know, people like that disrupting things as they see it in Latin America. I have to say, I think also there are two other things. Firstly, the president, this president and some of the people around him perhaps feel that this is going to be an easy win and that the president who's running into various political problems might need that. I think that's a small thing, but there may be some of that there. And I think the overarching geopolitical one is that there's a sense that China is there on the horizon. Russia is too. They're starting to make inroads in Latin America. Latin America is part of the Western Hemisphere. There is talk at the moment of focusing on the defense of the Western Hemisphere. So you do not want a large country in Latin America with large oil reserves and a socialist government that might perhaps one day align itself too closely with China and with the BRICS states. And I think that's probably the single most important factor.
And I mean, yeah, I mean, we certainly don't want to worry about trying, I don't know, diplomacy. We don't want to try and worry about giving them a reason to want to stay in our orbit. I mean, if that was the reason, then the least expensive and the most effective means would have been to accept Maduro's offer just a few weeks ago when he literally laid it out on a golden platter and said, basically, you can take my oil wealth and stuff. It appeared to me, tell me what you think, that Maduro was basically saying, I want to stay in power and I'm cool. If you want to take some of our oil, just don't take me out with it. We'll just give you some of it. And we'll just call it a day. How did you see that dynamic?
Well, that's exactly what the offer apparently was. And it was negotiated on behalf of the administration by Rick Grenell, who has been previously a friend and close to the president. And I believe has acted as acting national director of national intelligence in the previous the president's first term. So yes, there was a good deal there to be made. And I'm going to say something else. I think that one of the reasons why, in spite of the many challenges that have been faced by this current government in Venezuela, why it has been able to see off all of these challenges is precisely because it's been able to play up the story that the United States is out to get it. And that provides a certain rally around the government feeling in Venezuela. And after all, there's been a long history, as if we all know, of US involvement in Latin America. And there's all sorts of issues that play around that. But absolutely, diplomacy, negotiation, economic engagement, more likely than not, this is my view, sanctions have been lifted. If the United States had gone in, if Chevron had been able to develop the oil industry, over time, the government of Venezuela, the regime, if you prefer to call it that, would have started to change and change its policies and its direction. And who knows, maybe it would have quietly melted away, in the course of time as Venezuela itself changed. Instead, we have this situation.
Well, yeah, and let's just for the moment agree, and I do, that there is a lot of the reasons you just mentioned about the geostrategic issues and who we don't want around in there, et cetera, and what we do want for the United States. So all that was on the table then. And this was puzzling to me. And I'm having a hard time coming up with the rational explanation for this. If those things were the ultimate objectives, then it seems like when Maduro made that offer, then Trump would have accepted it. But instead, watch the reaction he had when addressed with that in the Oval Office.
Maduro offered everything in his country, all the natural resources. He even recorded a message to you in English recently offering mediation. What should we do to stop that?
He has offered everything. He's offered everything. You're right. You know why? Because he doesn't want to fuck around with the United States.
Okay, well, pretty coarse language, and he kind of got aggravated about it. Why wouldn't he have said, yeah, that's a great idea. We're going to go ahead and move down that. Instead, it's like he said, it seemed that it made him annoyed that Maduro was trying to find a diplomatic way out, and instead he continues to build up the combat power. How do you interpret that?
Well, we come back to the point that I think there is an element of personal animus on the president, on the president's part. He doesn't like that this man Maduro withstood this previous attempt to remove him. He finds that annoying in some way, and I think he also believes that he's perhaps going to get an easy win here. That probably Maduro isn't very popular in Venezuela, that his regime is fragile, that his military is fragile too. So probably the president believes, that if he takes this military action, it will be relatively straightforward. He'll obviously get the oil, he'll keep the Chinese out, and at the same time, he will look a winner. I think this is extraordinarily bad thinking. And by the way, I think the geopolitical thinking is utterly wrong as well. I think absolutely, as you do, that doing a deal with the current government in Venezuela would have been a far more intelligent and effective way of countering Chinese influence, if that is indeed your objective. But I think that there is that element of personal animus and that sense of, you know, vanity, maybe that desire, maybe let's not say vanity, that desire to achieve a quick win.
Yeah, and that is probably why there's all this combat power. In fact, the Wall Street Journal was kind of pointing out the obvious, where they're talking about you're sending all this power down there, and this is in yesterday's Wall Street Journal. It says, but the arrival of the USS Gerald R. Ford carrier strike group with several destroyers equipped with Tomahawk missiles will boost the U.S. military capacity to attack targets in the country, including Venezuela's air defenses. Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell said the carrier strike group will, quote, enhance and augment existing capabilities to disrupt narcotic trafficking and degrade and dismantle transnational criminal organizations, end quote. The strike group's firepower, however, goes beyond what is required to strike the small boats that the Trump administration says are being used to smuggle drugs. Listen, when people around the world hear that, whether it's in the UK or elsewhere in Europe, or China, or in Russia, and they hear these kinds of statements, oh yeah, this is to disrupt narcotics. I mean, come on, an aircraft carrier, nobody buys that. Why do we bother them saying things that are so self-evidently untrue? Why don't we just, I don't know, say what something is the truth? I guess you can't do that, right?
Well, presumably not, because that would then be straightforwardly illegal and it would be an act of aggression and all of those things, because Venezuela is no military threat to the United States at this time. And nobody anywhere thinks it is. So they come up with this very lame, very feeble excuse that President Maduro is somehow involved in drug trafficking, or more to be more precise, that he is the head of some great drugs cartel, and that his government is essentially a drugs cartel. And this is all being packaged and presented in that way. I think there is another factor at play here, which is where which I don't think played out perhaps as they hoped it would, but everybody around the world knows that there is this problem with Latin American drugs, cocaine trafficking. It's common in the United States. It's known that in many Latin American countries, the cartels are interconnected with governments in much of Latin America, or at least the government structures in much of Latin America. So I think there was perhaps a hope or a belief that some people in the United States and around the world who are genuinely upset about drugs and the illegal flow of drugs would be taken in by this and would, for that reason, at least give this operation the benefit of the doubt, or perhaps even their support. Well, that doesn't seem to have worked out. It was too transparent. And I don't think in the end, people were persuaded by that argument at all.
Well, and look, I mean, you're taking a look at this map here that Gary's got up here. This is the location of the strikes that we've gotten so far, and the claim being that this is an counter narcotics operation, and these are drug boats, and all this, and we have perfect intelligence, et cetera. But there has been a lot of claims that a lot of these boats aren't actually drug boats. As a matter of fact, Colombia has been just vociferously upset, saying that some of their people, fishermen, were killed. There's been some interviews with some of the surviving family members of some of these people who say they absolutely were not. And of course, you can claim, well, that's not true. They were. They're just saying that now to try to cover over them. But let me ask you another question. Since you're an attorney by trade, is there any legal justification for the United States to go and kill all of these people with effective summary execution because they're alleged to have been conducting drugs? Is there any legal basis for summarily killing all these people?
I don't think there's any at all. And I haven't heard anybody argue that there is. Not convincingly. Nobody that I'm aware of believes that this is an acceptable way to go about things. I mean, there is drugs smuggling in the Caribbean, and there is, as we can see, in the Pacific. But that's a police matter, and it's dealt with by police agencies, the Coast Guard in the United States, other police agencies. You stop these boats, you arrest the people on them, you search them for drugs, you bring charges, you deal with that kind of problem in that sort of way. As I understand it, these are attacks on boats, speed boats. Mostly they're attacked without warning. To many people, it looks like it's murder on the high seas. And I should say that I understand that that is a widespread view within the British Royal Navy. And a British Royal Navy officer, Tom Sharp, who writes regularly for the British media, I understand, has already said as much, that he himself is appalled that the United States Navy, with which he has worked closely and for which he has very high regard, is being used in this way.
Well, and as it turns out, it's apparently not just some people, you know, in the UK. The UK itself has, at least it was reported yesterday, that the UK has suspended intelligence operations with the United States. Gary, I want to skip that one for the moment. And if you can go to that one. UK suspends some intelligence sharing with US over boat strike concerns as a major break. This would seem to be a pretty big deal for the UK to make a break with the US on anything, because in fact, the UK is often derided as being a lapdog or a poodle to the United States, et cetera. But now here to break with this, that would seem to be a pretty big deal. How do you read this?
Yeah, it's a huge deal. And you're quite right. I mean, for the British government to do this, it shows that there is very, very serious concern. And I suspect some of that concern is coming from within the Navy and also from the police agencies here. And Britain also has problems with drugs, and we have drugs flowing from Latin America. And I think people in Britain, in the law enforcement agencies, actually are very unhappy that this serious issue is being hijacked and misused in this way, and these blatantly legal steps of, as I said, killing people on the high seas without due process and without proper warning is taking place. For the Starmer government to take a step like this, it shows how big the concern in Whitehall, and by the way, in Parliament too, must be.
Now, you spoke about the illegality of it just in international law. It also pretty directly violates American law, both the U.S. Constitution and the 1973 War Powers Act, that doesn't allow you to just unilaterally attack into another country or on the high seas, as the case is here. And when asked recently about whether Trump should at least seek congressional authorization or a declaration of war against these so-called drug lords, etc., here's how he responded.
I don't think we're going to necessarily ask for a declaration of war. I think we're just going to kill people that are bringing drugs into our country. Okay? We're going to kill them.
So I'm not going to follow the rule of law. I'm not going to follow international law. I'm just going to kill them. Now, this is something that kind of transcends this whole issue to me, or at least encapsulates it. And you have the president of the United States literally saying to the world, anyone, our allies in the UK, our potential adversaries in Venezuela, the challengers and maybe in Russia and China. I'm not bound by the rule of law. If I want to kill somebody, I'm going to kill them. Who's going to do anything about it? And so far, is China, is Russia, is Britain? How do you see that?
Yeah, I find it absolutely shocking. I find it horrifying that the president of the United States, the leader of the world's most powerful democracy, the man who has sworn an oath to the observe and abide by the Constitution, and who is responsible ultimately for the enforcement of law, should speak in this absolutely crude way and show an absolute disregard for law and for due process. I mean, absolutely shocking. And can I just say, I mean, he accuses the government of Venezuela of being a criminal cartel, and he talks in this way himself. I mean, who is the criminal here? I mean, it's I don't like to ask that kind of question about the president of the United States, but in a sense, it asks itself.
Well, and look, I mean, even you and I sitting here talking this, I have a similar viewpoint. You're like, okay, well, you don't actually want to call the president of the United States a murderer and a criminal, though that is what the evidence certainly leads to. And yet the question, so UK has taken this action here, at least privately. Now, what was reported yesterday was that apparently UK did this pretty early in the process, but like over a month ago, and only now did it come out, which means that they wanted to do it quietly, if the reporting is correct. But the question I have of you is there anything the U.S. could do? And especially if the USS Gerald R. Ford and this military strike group out here starts literally taking lethal military action against the country of Venezuela with no pretext, just to kill the leader or drive him from power, which violates every law that there is in the international affair. Is there anything that the United States could do that would cause our allies in Great Britain or anywhere else to actually break with the United States on this issue, or will it effectively be just a submission? What do you think?
I think they will go along with it. I mean, I think one thing I would say is that the British government doesn't like President Maduro at all, and they will not shed many tears if he's overthrown, and it's not a great concern. Once upon a time, it was different. When President Reagan sent the US military to overthrow the government of Grenada in 1983, with much more cause, by the way, than what we're seeing now. The British Prime Minister of that time, Margaret Thatcher, was absolutely furious and said this is completely illegal, and complained about the fact that this was also a Commonwealth country, which accepted the British Queen as its sovereign, and she complained to the president, to President Reagan, about it. But I cannot imagine the British government going that far as to break with the United States over an issue like this. I think where, if you want to look for a negative reaction, my guess is the place to look would be Latin America itself. I think that the Latin American countries, even many of them that are friendly to the United States, will not like this. Some of Latin American countries do not like President Maduro. It's known that President Lula of Brazil doesn't like President Maduro, for example. But they will not be happy about seeing the United States coming back and conducting armed interventions and overthrowing governments in Latin America, in South America, in this way. And I suspect not just governments, but many people in South America will feel the same way also.
What do you think this medium and possibly long-term implications could be for the West, not even just the United States? Let's just, even for the moment, let's just say that we don't launch military operations, but we just... all the things we've done, because we continue to do these things, there's no evidence we're going to stop killing people in these boats out there and just claiming that they're drug operations, and just ignoring whole scale, whole cloth, or the rule of law, just this, the concept of the rule of law. What does this do to us as a culture? And I'm talking the Western culture here, that we are now doing the very things blatantly and unapologetically out in the open that we used to roundly condemn others for doing, for killing people? Or can we just say, well, as long as it's just 75 or 76, I think is the current number of people that are killed. I don't know. They're not anybody I know. Maybe they're guilty. Not a big concern of mine. Sure, kill them all. What is the consequence to us if we continue to devalue human life like that and being okay with the violations of the rule of law?
I think they are profound, and I think they're long lasting. I know many people think otherwise, but I think if we get into the habit of just killing people, and it was the president of the United States who used the word kill. I mean, he didn't need to use that word, but he did. He chose that word. If we start doing that, if we throw away law and due process and all of the restraints that come with us, then I'm afraid we are coarsening our democracy, our democracies, our legal systems. We are undermining them and we are discrediting them. And it's important to say this. I think there is a misunderstanding that many people have that you can behave badly overseas. You can do all of these things. You can overthrow governments, engage in violence, unconstrained violence in that sort of way. And that's for export. And it doesn't affect you at home. I profoundly disagree. I think in time it does. If you show no regard for law in relation to a country like Venezuela, then eventually you're going to start having a cynical view about law in your own country, and you're going to start to demoralize law and due process in your own country too. And given that there's already been challenges to due process in the United States, that's a very bad thing altogether.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. Is that not to a certain extent already happening? I mean, we have the Trump administration who just violates laws left and right, who says things out loud and in the open that are just as self-evidently untrue as what they're saying here about sending the Gerald R. Ford to do counter drug missions and all that kind of stuff. The Supreme Court or other courts will make orders and tell things that, according to our law, should compel and constrain the administrative branch, but they say, yeah, we don't agree with that. We don't like it. We're going to do whatever we want. There's every evidence in the world that both the Biden administration before and now the Trump administration is using the instruments of law to go after their political opponents here, and that the rule of law in many cases are already starting to not apply. They're just ignoring it whole cloth. For example, this may seem small, Alexander, but to me, it's just another chink in the red. During this shutdown that we currently had here, there are laws in the way the Congress allocates money that says if we allocate money for a certain thing, especially like, say, within the Department of Defense, it has to go for that purpose. You can't get the money and then for the budget and then on your own just say, yeah, but I'd rather actually spend it over here. So we're going to move it. There's a law against that. So you can't just move money around. But then we said, okay, because it's politically inconvenient to have this shutdown and not pay our armed forces, which was one of the consequences of that. We just said, you know what? We're going to move it over here. And when the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, was asked about that, he literally laughed at the reporter who asked the question and said, are you really going to make that argument that we're going to just worry about what the law says and we're going to bring a court case or something just because we're going to pay the military? And of course, they back down, the Democrats back down, et cetera. They've now done more of that. Now they've moved it from even more disparate locations to pay armed forces and law enforcement and the military on the last payday. No one says a thing about it. So you keep shredding the law in littler ways here. And that's not that little, actually, but it basically says, hey, whether it's international law or domestic law, we're going to do whatever we think, whatever we can politically get away with. Where does it end?
Well, it is absolutely disastrous. Firstly, it is disastrous because what it means is that Congress no longer has control over the budget, because the Congress passes a budget, allocates funds for various purposes, but the president then makes all kinds of completely arbitrary decisions, deciding how he's going to spend that money. And he goes against the will of Congress in doing that. So we really are then in a situation of if you like, the imperial presidency or something of that kind. There is a bigger issue, which is, what is the United States? The United States is a republic, a system based on law, founded on the Constitution. That, in my opinion, is the source of America's greatness. It is what lies at the root of what the United States is. If you have a government in the United States that no longer takes heed of that, that goes against the Constitution, which gives Congress the power to pass budgets and things of that kind, then you are moving away from what the United States is, and you making it into something else, far worse. You are moving away from the Republic and from the Constitution, and you're moving into something very dark and very different, which absolutely, as somebody who actually has a great admiration for the United States, I absolutely do not want to see.
And what do you say to people who would go, Davis, look, you guys are just over-exaggerating here. That's a dumb law anyway. They shouldn't have it. I don't think it's a good one. He should be able to do what he wants with his own money. What do you say to people like that? You say, well, yeah, but it helps. It functions here. He wanted to do something. We got our military paid. So, I mean, if that's the price we had to pay, it's kind of a small one. I mean, we got to pay them. What do you say to those kind of arguments?
Well, it's not his money. It's the taxpayers' money. Which the taxpayers elect Congress to decide how it should be spent. Obviously, the president can come to Congress and present a budget, but they have to agree. If you agree to this kind of thing, you are disempowering yourself, because you are no longer in a position to hold the president and the executive to account for what it does as a U.S. taxpayer and a U.S. citizen.
And of course, and I would add to that, that there are ways to get things done. There were legal pathways to get the government, the military paid, get the government back open. So you could have done the harder work and still had the same outcome by following the rule of law. So we are cutting corners because we don't want to do the hard work. What I worry about is that gone far enough that people are get too comfortable with saying that these laws are okay for them to file because I'm okay with this. I like this outcome. Mm-hmm. But how often have you seen it in history where a certain group are comfortable with their guy violating certain laws and going down and shredding the balance of power? And then all of a sudden things shift, and now all of a sudden the next time they're not in a position of power and someone else comes up and uses those same proclivities, but in ways they don't like. And now what do you do? I mean, where does it end?
Well, that's exactly, I mean, it's happened many times in history. I mean, I don't want to start picking off presidents, but, you know, we can all name them. I mean, I saw a television film based on events in Germany, for example, in the late 1920s and early 1930s. And there was a culminating moment when there was a court case involving people who were being prosecuted for a specific crime. And the person who was defending them, the lawyer who was defending them, suddenly realized that nothing was happening in the way that it should. And that, you know, the judge had already made decisions, that he was taking papers that he shouldn't be receiving from all sorts of people from outside, that he was consulting outside, not talking to people in the courtroom. We know exactly where that led. And you can find that in many cases. If I can give another example, the Roman Republic, that's where we get the word republic from, it collapsed again because people in the Republic didn't observe its constitution and its laws. And it became an empire, which is an arbitrary dictatorship. And if you know anything about Roman history, you know exactly what that was all about and how that ended. So these are not good things. If you believe in democracy and freedom, then you must believe in the Constitution, in the rule of law, in due process, because without those things, you're in a world of arbitrary and ultimately tyrannical government. The founders of the United States knew that extremely well. Just go to the Federalist Papers and you will find it all there.
Yeah, I have read a lot of those and do view this with great concern and trepidation, as it were. And all we can do is do what we're doing now, is shining a light on the reality and the truth of this and giving warnings that even what may seem good for you today, violating the law, won't end up that way. And it has bad habits of going really dark later on. But all we can do is be unintimidated and uncompromised to bring the truth, no matter what it is. And we are very grateful for you coming on to doing that exact same thing today. And we really appreciate you.
Thank you very much, Daniel. Thank you.
And always a pleasure to have you on. And we actually have another show. We got two more shows coming up. I don't know if you've heard, but there's, and some of this could be even related to what's happening here in the Venezuela area. New Epstein emails have been released, which apparently mentioned Trump repeatedly. We're going to have Robert Barnes, also an attorney, help us trying to discuss that, figure out where that is. That's at 1 o'clock today. We'll be seeing you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.